God,
God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, we have anybody here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you by first name. You are allowed to unmute yourself. Anybody?
I'm Rachel, and today is day 3.
Rachel, welcome.
Thank you.
Glad you're here.
I'm glad to be here.
So, anybody else in the first 30 days? Is there anybody here who recently has moved to the Norfolk area?
That would be me, John.
John, welcome, brother. I'm going to throw I'll throw my number out in the chat. Fortunately, in the chat at this time, everyone is allowed to chat publicly. So if anybody wants to offer their number, just know that you're doing that for everyone. And then that will be that'll be disallowed once the meeting starts as well. So welcome. Glad you're all here. The preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous states that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. The format of this meeting is an open speaker ask it basket. Tonight, we are very excited to have Arisa B. from Boston, Massachusetts. And I think it's Boston, Massachusetts, not Georgia, right? And after she tells her story, we'll take a short break at the top of the hour for the seventh tradition, maybe a couple of announcements, et cetera. But most of all, we want you guys to submit your questions, because we'll reconvene. And for the last half an hour of the meeting, we will interview Arisa. And there is a user in here called Questions. It's really Larry. But just as questions occur to you, please feel free to chat them to Larry, and he will wrangle them, and then we'll interview Arisa. She is my kind of AA. We had another speaker scheduled for tonight, and it was just a joy scheduling you in the first place for January 17th, just getting to know you and chatting a little bit. One of these AAs that picks up the telephone when you ring her, very pleasant to deal with. And then the speaker we had for tonight, is sick today, and I sent her a text and she said yes. So I don't want to take up another minute of your time. I'm very excited to hear your story. Thank you again.
Thank you, Dave. David. Oh, I'm sorry, we just did that. My name's Arisa, and I'm very definitely an alcoholic. The date of my last drink was October the 13th of 1993. And for that, I am truly grateful. Although I really wasn't when I got here. I'll give you a couple of more statistics. First, I want to say thank you again to David for asking me to speak. It's always an honor and a privilege to get to speak for Alcoholics Anonymous. I wanted to welcome Rachel. Rachel, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous, day 3. That is, incredible. 3 days, continuously, 72 hours, that is a long time between drinks. And I'm not just saying that. I mean, I remember very, very clearly what day 3 was like for me, which maybe I'll talk about in a minute, maybe I won't. And John, welcome to the area, even though I'm coming from afar. I've moved a lot in sobriety, and getting connected to a group nearby is what I was taught to do right away, to jump in and go to a lot of meetings and get to know people and make myself known. And that's what we do. So, I really enjoyed getting to talk to David last week, I think, when we were scheduling, and we had a really nice conversation. He was telling me a lot about your group and to be invited somewhere to feel the love of Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most important things in my life today. It really, really is. And like I said, that's not how it was when I got here. a few more statistics. I live in the Boston area. I technically live in Brookline, which if you know Boston, I can see Fenway Park from here. But you know, Boston grew up around Brookline. My home group is the Beacon Group. We meet on Monday nights for a big book study, on Thursday nights for a three speaker meeting, and Monday through Friday at noon from noon to one for a step study meeting. I go to a lot of meetings. I have a lot of service positions. I just rotated off as the area literature chair. I serve on my home group. I was one of the 9 Zoom operators to help get the General Service Conference online this year. I love doing service in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thrown into service very, very early, meaning like before I got to lead my first meeting, they had me washing ashtrays, and I don't smoke. And I've never left service. I'm a 3 legacies girl, and I was lucky to have been taught that. I was born in Corpus Christi, Texas. And if you don't know where that is, that's about 4 hours south of Houston, 4 hours north of Mexico, on the coast of the Gulf of Mexico. There were banana trees in the backyard, palm trees in the front yard. My mother used to say, you're dressed up if you're wearing shoes. So it was a very tropical climate, and it was hot. We didn't even have air conditioning. So I come from a long line of alcoholics on my mother's side and on my father's side, but my mother was the adult child of an alcoholic. My dad's the adult child of a missionary, and those don't mix very well, I got to tell you. And I'm sure you can tell by my red tresses that I am a card carrying, still to this day, Brazilian citizen. So I fit more in more here than I did anywhere else, but here in Boston. We were really poor growing up, and it was a really violent home. Dad was very, very abusive. There was a lot of ugly stuff that went on, and most of that was in the name of God. And I remember going to my mother, and I know the general age because of some of the things that were around me. So it was before I even went to kindergarten, and I told her that Dad was hitting me, and she said, well, what did you do to deserve it? And I learned right there never to ask for help, never to ask for help. I didn't know that anybody would ever protect me. I loved going to church as a child, absolutely loved it. And I built an altar in the bottom of my closet for all of my stuffed animals, where I would sit in there and I would sing to them, you know, because singing was something that was very precious to me, that I learned in church. And I felt loved when I was in church when I was little. And that the door in the hall outside had swung so many times, it had broken a hole through the sheetrock. So there was this little beam of light that would come down, you know, like the, there, you know, over the altar in the church where I was, they always had one light shining down on the altar. Was it, you know, never to be turned off. And so this was, you know, this was where I spent a lot of my time. And especially when Dad was raging, and I'd be down in that closet with my stuffed animals, and I'd be praying that he wouldn't find me, but he always did. You know, and I learned early on that there wasn't going to be anybody taking care of me. I don't know when exactly I got conscious of how different the family was than everybody else, but it wasn't too terribly long. I remember being in fourth grade and thinking like things were really wrong and that someday I was going to have to fix it. And I also remember thinking a few years after that, that life was just one big game and all you had to do was learn to play it, right? And so I started to do, you know, certain things to build my self-esteem, to prove to you that I was important. Because if you would think that I was important, maybe I would think that I was important. Maybe if you liked me enough, I would start to like me. I hated myself. And I didn't know why I hated myself, except that, I mean, I was a very abused child. And I was abused at school. I was abused at home, you know. And you learn. You know, I remember hearing about the monks and self-flagellation and all this. And like my religion, we don't even have monks. you know, but I'm really like hearing about them hitting their, you know, so I start doing this to myself to beat the badness out of me. You know, I had this idea that if I tried harder, I would do better. And so, you know, when I finally got a drink, I got to tell you, I think I was thirsty for a long time, really, really long time. And I was 15 years old and I was with my best friend at the time. And mind you, actually, she wasn't my best friend at the time. She became my best friend later, I think because she was access to alcohol. You know, it's funny because I realized recently when I tell this story, I always talk about my best friend at the time, but really we hadn't hung out together much. You know, it was really our first night out spending much time together. We both worked on the newspaper. She was a senior and, you know, older, wiser, and she had very, you know, a mother who let her do whatever she wanted to because her father had died and she had access to alcohol. And so I'm sitting on a pier with her drinking. She'd made this sticky concoction. She had one nip that she put in a big blender full of strawberry daiquiris, frozen strawberry daiquiris. And we sat there and we watched the sun go down and we're good girls. We don't throw our cups away. So we're carrying them back to the car. And she kind of elbows me and she's drop your cup. So I do. And there's an undercover police officer. And I get a minor in possession for possessing zero alcohol, zero alcohol. That's the way my drinking went. I got to tell you, I am a girl who like, if you don't, I really felt for many, many years, like there was just this Eeyore cloud above me. You know, if something bad was going to happen, stand back because it's coming this way. That's just the way, you know, the way it felt. Right. Hopefully I'll come back to that later. Anyway, so that night after getting the minor in possession and he searched the car, we didn't have any alcohol. We didn't. She had had one nip. That was all she had. That was all there, all Europe. But I looked at her and I said, if I'm going to be in this much trouble, I'm going to deserve it. And the truth is that, you know, here's the really, really twisted part of the story. Like, I didn't know that it was illegal for me to be drinking. I had no clue. My parents gave me sips of alcohol. I say it was my first night drinking because it was my first night out drinking. It was the first time I went drinking. Every other bit of alcohol I had had up until that point was given to me by my parents. You know, a little bit of champagne on New Year's Eve, you know, a little sip of this and a little sip of that. You know, I knew what Schomburg was and, you know, random things. And my mother liked sticky sweet stuff. She'd taught me to pour Kahlua over my ice cream. I mean, isn't that normal? So why would anybody have been upset about, you know, me having split a daiquiri with this person? I just didn't know it was against the law. And if I had gone home that night and talked to my parents, probably wouldn't have gotten in trouble. But that's not how my brain was thinking. My brain was thinking already that I believe that the phenomenon of craving was already there, right? With half a nip in me, right? And I looked at Kelly and I convinced her to take me back to her grandparents' house where I found a screwdriver and I took the hinges off of the liquor cabinet where I proceeded to have a drink out of every single bottle in that liquor cabinet. She didn't do that. I did. And by the end of the night, she had to contain me. I had broken things. I was throwing up. I mean, she had invited some boys over. There was this boy who really liked me and he never came close to me again after that night, you know, and that's how it was. Like, here's the thing I realized in retrospect, I couldn't understand this at the time. But see, when I start drinking, I'm married to a non-alcoholic and God bless him, he's a sweetheart, David. And when David drinks, he starts to get slightly tipsy and he feels out of control. So he stops. I don't understand that. Right. And I've been telling him, we've been married for over 20 years now. And I keep telling him, honey, just keep pushing. You'll get past it. Keep going. You can get there if you try. He has zero interest in getting past there. Because when I drink, you see, here's the thing. Like, I don't get from alcohol what he gets from alcohol. When he drinks, he gets out of control. When I drink, I don't get slightly tipsy and out of control. When I drink, Baby, I get in control. When I drink, I can handle it. Whatever it is, you bring it on, I can handle it. I get the promises that are so often read in meetings. I get those from drinking. They're not the promises of Alcoholics Anonymous, by the way. There are a lot of promises in my big book, okay? The promises that people read in meetings, those are all things that I get by drinking. I intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. I know how my experience can benefit others. You know, I get all of those things from alcohol. Alcohol for me is a spiritual experience. I think, you know, I think it was Carl Jung who said, you know, they call it spirits for a reason. You know, like I get inspired, right? Alcohol does something for me that it will never do for the average person out there. You know, when it was explained to me finally that I had an allergy to alcohol, this made no sense to me at first. It really didn't. You know, what are you talking about? It's not like I get hives, right? And I don't break out in handcuffs. That's not my experience either. I had to wait till I got sober to get arrested, by the way. So, you know, I don't break into handcuffs or any of that. You know, it's a lot of the things people talk about in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, what we have in common is not what happened to us. It's what happens inside of me. And what happens inside of me, you see, I have to stay clear on the effect produced by alcohol. Because if I don't understand what alcohol does for me, right? And if you can't, if it doesn't do this for David. And because what alcohol does for me does not happen to David, he has never let alcohol do to him what I let it do to me, right? You have to have some sort of effect from this. You know, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced, right? What's the effect? Like I said, I can handle it. It's gonna be okay. It was like somebody tiptoed up behind me and pulled the plastic bag off from the top of my head. I didn't know I had been slowly suffocating. There had just never been quite enough oxygen in the room. But I felt more truly me when I drank. I felt like this is how life is supposed to be. So I didn't understand why everybody didn't want to drink all the time. Who wouldn't want that? You know? And if less is more, think about how much better more would be. Right? I mean, I get thirsty. When I drink, I get thirsty. I don't know about you, but I'm a thirsty girl. I'm just a thirsty girl. You know, my favorite drink is what do you got? What do you got? Right? And what's one? Until it's gone. Until it's gone. You know, I never drank great stuff. I was a teenager. Most of my drinking happened underage. You know, I mean, really, like it was in high school. And, you know, everybody's favorite drink in high school is What You Got or Mad Dog 2020. You know, I prefer What You Got over Mad Dog 2020, but I'll take either, you know. Within 6 months of that first time drinking, that first night out with Kelly, I'm in Austin, Texas, drinking on 6th Street in bars. It is illegal for me to even be on the premises. I'm 15 years old. You're not allowed to be on the premises unless you're 18. And here I am thinking that my case is different. It's okay. I'm 5'11". Nobody questioned whether or not I was 18. They just let me in, right? And it's always, I am the exception to the rule, always. You know, I am the girl who, if you tell me no, I'm gonna prove to you that I can. That's who I am. I don't know why I'm that way, right? I remember my older sister talking about, she was talking not in a nice way about some people in her class. And she's like, oh, they're just a bunch of alkies. And I'm thinking, I can't wait to be one of them. I wanted to be there. I was the party girl before I knew where the party was. I was the party girl before I understood what alcohol was. I didn't know. I didn't understand alcoholism. I didn't understand any of this stuff, but I was drawn to this like a moth to the flame. You know, all I knew was that I wanted something to change me, you know, because I wasn't okay with me. It was like my skin was too tight and I was just one big raw nerve. But when I drank, everything just became better. Or for those of you who remember, you know, The Wizard of Oz, the movie, right? She starts out in Kansas and it's all black and white and drab and blah. And then she comes to Oz and it's Technicolor. And that's the way the world was for me. Everything was more beautiful when I was drinking. I was taller. I was Australian. I was, you know, I wish I was lying about that, but that's true. True story. You know, I break out in accents. I'm quite the actress. That first night in a bar, I get abducted and raped. I am the girl, add alcohol, instant disaster. Not a lot of you guys have that kind of story. I understand that. And I got to tell you, when I came to you, I hated you for it. I hear stories about your first 5 or 10 good years. And I'm like, I didn't have 5 or 10 good minutes. I mean, I got in my possession before I ever had a drunk. Come on, that's not fair. In what world is that fair? I really thought that I wanted a fair life. Really did. Until I got to you. So my mother dropped me off at Alcoholics Anonymous the week after I graduated from high school. I was voted most likely to succeed. I was at the top of the class. I was going to be going to one of the best universities in the country. You know, I was little miss everything, right? You name it, homecoming, blah, 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 blah. You know, that was me, Little Miss Ray High School. And I wanted to kill myself. I couldn't take the pain anymore. I just couldn't take the pain. When I escaped and got home from that horrible night, I started drinking for oblivion, which Bill calls the sickest of all reasons, right? I came from such a religious background that I truly believed that because I wasn't a virgin anymore, that therefore I was going to hell. You know, that this idea of a loving God was not something I understood. I understood judgment. I understood being punished for every screw up, right? And if you aren't going to punish me, I'm going to punish me. The self-loathing that I had, I knew I wasn't worth saving. I just knew that. And every night I would pray that I just wouldn't live, that I could just die. Just die in my sleep. I mean, wouldn't God just have some mercy on me and kill me now, you know? And so instead, you know, that didn't happen. And I got my driver's license and I would sit at this T junction overlooking the Gulf of Mexico. And I'd be waiting for the light to turn green so I could floor it because I was just going to go over the edge. And this is before Thelma and Louise. So it wasn't like it was, you know, a thing. I didn't have the guts to do anything else. I actually don't think I knew that people cut their wrists. I mean, there was not a lot of remember there was no internet. You couldn't Google like good ways to commit suicide, you know, I didn't know. That was the only thing that really came up because I couldn't hold my breath long enough, evidently. This miracle would happen. I'd be sitting there waiting for the light to turn green. And all of a sudden I would remember that there was a keg party out at the beach and I would end up going out to the beach and I would drink. And Bill writes about that too. The men of high finance, jumping from the towers of high finance, and that disgusted him. He went to the bar. You see, I didn't understand that alcohol treats alcoholism. I have alcoholism and I didn't know I had it. And I was treating my alcoholism and I didn't know what I was treating. Had no clue. My best friend at the time, Sarah, she suffered from terrible depression. We were both, we were a mess. We were a match set of disaster twins, you know, wonder twin powers all the way. And we would be in my car and we'd roll up the windows as we're driving along Ocean Drive. And we'd be screaming at the top of our lungs to just try and take some of the pressure off. You know, we'd go out to these parties, I'd drag her with me, and she'd have half a wine cooler, and she'd be like, oh, I'm so buzzed. I don't know, I buzzed past buzz, never been buzzed, don't know what a buzz is. You know, like, I drink for effect. You know, I was thinking the other day about this one night where I drank the entire bottle of Jack Daniels by myself. And what I remember is, I don't even know how I got it. I think I stole it from somebody. I have no idea. I know where I was. I remember the bushes. I remember cracking the seal. And I remember finishing the bottle. And if I remember finishing the bottle, it had to have happened in a very short amount of time. I chugged that thing, just chugged it, because I drink for effect. I drink for effect, you know, and the more I drink, the thirstier I get. And I have no idea about what moderating is, right? And I used to be jealous of Sarah because she would get buzzed. And she would talk about what buzzed is. I'd be like, what is buzzed? You know, like, when, can you explain this concept to me? Because I know plastered, but I don't know buzzed, right? And I used to be jealous of her. But the truth is, alcohol didn't do for her what it does for me. And because it doesn't do for her what it does for me, she didn't get the effect produced, right? She didn't get the relief that I got from drinking, and she committed suicide. Alcohol saved my life. Alcohol saved my life. And so when people started talking to me about, maybe you should be looking at your drinking, do you think maybe you drink too much? I'm thinking, I think it's time to get new friends. I'm thinking, I hear Charlie Brown's teacher, wah, 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 wah. I like, you don't know what you're talking about. You're crazy. You're crazy. I remember the morning after my last drunk, I went to my parents' house. And my dad says, I don't understand. If this happens to you when you drink, why don't you just not drink? And I'm thinking, you freaking idiot. Like, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. Because for you to ask me to not drink is for you to ask me to not breathe. You're asking me not to breathe. You see, this is what, like, I'm good at quitting. David and I were talking earlier. I'm a quitter. I'm a good quitter. I can quit anything. I'm just not good at staying quit. I can't quit quitting. You know, I can't stop the cycle. It always looks like a good idea eventually. And the reason is, if you leave me restless, irritable, and discontented long enough, I know what will fix that. I have way too much experience getting just enough relief. It's saving my life just long enough. Saved my life long enough to get me to you. Again, you know, if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you can't, it's hard to tell on Zoom. We are so happy you're here. Like, when I walked into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was like whoosh, you know, like people just like, it's like mosquitoes, like, get them off me. Like, who are these people? Like, you know, blood suckers or something. But we love newcomers here. We are so happy you're here. Rachel, you know, like, so excited you're here. We are so happy you're here. The truth is, we really don't care if you're happy to be here or not. That's the honest truth. Like, you know, we love you, you know, and nobody had said that to me in a while. And I sure didn't believe him either. And when I walked into that first meeting down in Corpus Christi, Texas, and I had, I was coming off of a really bad drunk. So here's my idea of controlled drinking. Nothing's crawling on you 3 days later that isn't a real thing, right? In other words, I'm trying to catch all the invisible, like, my skin is literally crawling. You know, I get the DTs. Like, I'm that girl. I don't know how that many people in AA who can really talk about getting the DTs anymore. You know, like, because everybody goes to treatment and they have, like, and that was another resentment I had, you know, like, you guys got to go to treatment. You got the easy one. I did the shake, rattle, and roll on the floor, you know, and I didn't like you for that either. Of course, I didn't like you for anything. I didn't like anybody for anything. You know, I actually, my name, by the way, it means the girl that smiles. Right? I wasn't smiling at anybody when I got here. Nobody. I was one angry girl. And although I am wearing black tonight, I never wore anything but black. And I mean, I did everything I could to look tough. And when I walked into that first meeting, they were so kind. They really were. And in that Texas way, they said, oh, honey, we're so glad you're here. Why don't you come have a seat over here? And why don't you take that cotton out of your ears and put it in your mouth? Why don't you learn to listen to learn? And then, like I said, they got me washing ashtrays and I don't smoke. You know, they taught me that, you know, service was part of this deal from the very beginning. They assigned me a sponsor. She had 2 months of sobriety. And she was a chronic relapser. And, you know, she was back and she was working the steps and she was, you know, she was on her amends. And they knew that if she didn't start helping somebody else, that she was going to drink again. So they gave her me. Let's be honest. I mean, what were my odds anyway, right? You know what I mean? Hey, How bad could she mess it up? Right? I'm probably going to leave anyway. Right? She needs the practice. So they gave her me. And I joke a lot that she was probably only about a page or so ahead of me in the big book, you know, and it was very, very imperfect. But she said a few things to me that have stayed with me. She said things like, you know, I think that if you don't work these steps, you're going to drink again. And you know what? I didn't want to drink again. I was tired of it. I had spent the last 3.5 years trying not to drink. And I was a periodic. And this is the part that kept me out of AA for a while. You know, that I didn't understand if you weren't drinking all the time, whether or not you were alcoholic. I didn't understand the phenomenon of craving, because I thought that that meant every time I drink, I had to get annihilated. Right? What they taught me this time was that it's more like Russian roulette, right? That there are bullets in the chamber. And that with my history, let's be honest, with my history, how many people here think this girl should try drinking again? You'd have to be stupid or crazy to drink again. And I'm not stupid. So I could get that there was something going on with me that was different. You know, nobody else, none of my girlfriends were doing what I was doing. I'm drinking with the football players, you know? I'm drinking with the really big guys, and I'm drinking them under the table. And I'm thinking things like, you know, well, alcoholics are people who don't think they drink too much. So I know I drink too much. So therefore I'm safe. I'm not alcoholic, right? That's alcoholic logic for you. How do you help somebody with a mind like that? Really? How? So they gave me to her, and she started me through the steps. And she told me some other things. She said, when your sponsor says jump, you don't ask why, you say, exactly how high would you like that? Right? And she also said, if you weren't there from prayer to prayer, it's my opinion you were not there. And that I needed to be there early and stay late. Right? She did all those things for me, like just to help me understand. Like I said, I think this is what her sponsor was telling her, and she was trying to practice. Right? And I did my first fifth step on Christmas Eve. Like I said, I got sober on October the 13th. So that's not that long by my standards anyway. And it was really imperfect, but I really, really, really wanted to not have to do this again. I was really tired. See, my idea of social drinking is you don't get the DTs. You know, 3 days later, you're not doing the shake, rattle, and roll. That's my idea of social drinking, you know? And I didn't want to do that again. And here's the miracle of it. As much as you can say, oh, you know, like, how could they have done that? You know, she's 2 months sober. The thing is that I stayed sober, and so did she. 27 plus years later, we're both still sober. We're both still sober, as imperfect as that was. Because I think we both had the desire to go to any lengths. Hopefully we both got a lot more out of it. When, you know, I went back to college and got a sponsor, actually understood the big book and knew more about it. And she's the one that really helped me to understand that inventory process. She's the one that helped me to, you know, figure out what to do with my resentments against my father and against the man who abducted me. And like, how do you deal with that? See, and the first thing I'll tell you is that I was taught originally by that first sponsor when I did inventory to look for my part. But the problem is this: if this is a whole, and this is a part, I never forget that you had a part. And in the big book, it says we disregard the other person entirely. So I've got to throw away this idea of a part. I have to resolutely look for my own mistakes. In an ideal world, you know, what do I wish I had done differently? It doesn't matter what you do. It matters what I do. Because as long as I am expecting you to change, I am trapped. I am trapped. If you have to act a certain way, then I am trapped. And we have to, you know, we get a lot of therapy speak in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous these days, you know, and one of the things I've heard a lot is in a major uptick on boundaries. And, you know, my sponsor told me, like, AA, where in this book does it ever say the word boundaries? Because you know what the problem is with a boundary? Is that David has to behave for me to be okay. If David misbehaves, then I lose my serenity. If David misbehaves, see, And that sponsor taught me, she said, listen, your family may have installed these buttons. You know, they did. They did a lot of damage. My family did a lot of damage. And they're still, they are a sick bunch of people. They really are, I got to tell you. You know, and I'd be happy to tell you some of those stories, but we'll probably run out of time long before that. But they installed these buttons. And she said, but honey, you can change the wiring so that when they come and they push that button, you don't have to sock them. You don't. You get to have a different response today. This is not, because as long as they push the button and I automatically do this, guess I'm just a puppet and they're pulling the strings. They have total power over my life. And I don't want those people to have power in my life today. I don't want anybody to have power in my life today. You know, I did a first step. And the thing about the first step is this, everybody says in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, that the first step is the only one that you can do perfectly. That is true. But we say it in such a way that it sounds like that if you do, you're safe. You're not. Before I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I absolutely knew that I was powerless over alcohol and that my life had become unmanageable. That was pretty darn clear, okay? Bill Wilson did a perfect first step. Dr. Bob, perfect first step. All three of us drank again. It's not the first step that keeps me sober. It's the first step that makes me willing to get open to a solution, right? And here's the other thing that I thought. I thought the first step was the first step, but I couldn't do a first step. Why couldn't I really do a first step? Because the people that I was talking to weren't alcoholics, because they didn't have the 12th step in their heart. In order for me to do a first step, somebody else has to have the 12th step in their heart. You know, it says that we only clear the ground a bit so that you can lay the foundation, right? That's the deal. And that's what those people were willing to do. That's what my very first temporary sponsor did for me. She was willing to help me clear the ground a bit. The first step in her heart, see, she wasn't going to stay sober unless she found a way to stop thinking about her. They told me when I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, honey, this is not a self-help program. And because I came here to fix me. And they said, oh, darling, you got to stop doing that. That's the whole problem. If you would just stop trying to fix you, everything would get better. The more you try to fix it, the worse it gets. Have you noticed? You know, and I did. I tried everything. I had the chatter of a thousand monkeys in my brain nonstop. So, I mean, I went to therapy. I took antidepressants. I learned to put my legs behind my head. Took all these religion classes, chanted with the Hare Krishnas. I paddled up the Amazon in a canoe and swam with the piranhas. And none of it could stop what was going on in here. Nothing could stop what's going on in here. But when you got your hands on me, when you wrapped me up in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you told me to stop trying to fix me, when you told me that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a self-help program, you also told me that Alcoholics Anonymous is a program where we help others so that we get out of God's way. Stop trying to fix it. I don't work on my character defects, because when I work on my character defects, they get worse, never better. You know, that's how you get them firmly entrenched. And you know, when I learned that one when I went back to college, and I'd done 1 through 5 with that first sponsor, and I'm looking for a new sponsor, and I asked this woman who terrified me if she'd sponsor me, and she said yes. And she said, what step are you on? And I said, I'm on step 6. And she goes, oh no. And I'm like, no, really, I'm on step 6. I just did my 5th step about, you know, a week or two ago. And she's like, no. No one is on step 6. You're on step 1. Okay, another resentment in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'm getting lots of practice with this inventory stuff. All right. I'm so glad that she did, because like I said, I mean, I didn't get out of that first inventory what really I should have gotten out of that inventory. But what I'm trying to say is that 6 and 7 for me, you know, if you want your character defects removed, go do 8 and 9. That's what I was taught. It's really hard for me to keep gossiping about you Like if I'm gossiping about somebody, right? And by the way, it doesn't mean that I go to that person and say, well, you know, I'm so sorry I was gossiping about you, because then you've given them a resentment. No, it's instead I'm going back. I was taught to go back to every single person I gossip to and say, you know, I was very wrong for saying those things and for trying to manipulate your opinion about her so that I could feel important. Yeah, gossip will stop being a character defect pretty quickly. That's how they get removed. I didn't do the removing. I get humble enough to say I was wrong. You know, I learned that amends, I don't know about you guys, but when I got here, like the idea, I don't even think I'd ever heard the word amends. I mean, that's a big fancy word for I'm sorry, right? But I don't think today that it is. When I think about, I knew what amendments were, but I wasn't thinking about that in terms of me, right? An amendment to the Constitution makes it better. If you mend your pants, you sew up the hole as if it was never there, right? And when I was taught that that's what amends were about, it was about healing the separation between you and me. It was about making it as if it had never happened to the best of my ability. See, when I go to somebody and I say, I'm sorry, what I really mean is please excuse my bad behavior and don't make me pay the price. That's what I really want. I just want off the hook. That's it. I'm just here to manipulate you because I'm cute. And, you know, most people will forgive me, or they'll say they do, and, you know, I'll get away with it, or so I think. But what I learned was this, is I never got away with anything. I never got away with anything. And you know why I couldn't forgive my dad and I couldn't forgive this man who abducted me? Because I was afraid they were going to get away with it if I did. Because here's the thing, when somebody is in jail, they're not the only one in that scenario. There's also somebody standing out there who's making sure they stay in, the jailer. And that was the role I ended up playing. I had to make sure you were being punished, because if you got off, that wasn't fair. And I really thought I wanted a fair world. I really thought that I deserved better. I really thought I should get what I deserved. God save us from getting what we deserve. And so this idea of going and making amends, what it was explained to me, and not so many words, but the way I understand it today is that every amends that I make, the thing is, I don't get in trouble by compromising your principles. It really doesn't bother me if you don't like what I'm doing, you know, and that's, you know, I feel guilty if I do something that you don't like. I really do. But all you've got to do is tell me what price I have to pay, and then it's over and it's done with. But guilt and shame, they're different. Right? Real remorse, that's different. That's when I've compromised my own principles. That's when I can't look myself in the eye. That's when I don't like me. That's when I can't stand myself. And that's when I don't believe that I belong on this earth, that there's enough anything, that I'm unlovable. That's when I start to believe that God made junk, right? And so in making amends, for the first time in my life, I'm going to you and I'm willing to be on the hook. I'm willing to be 100% on the hook. I want to take responsibility for the first time ever. And that's not to say be a doormat. Let me be very clear, like boundaries are you know, something like I said, I don't deal with. Because as God's people, we walk on our feet. We don't bow or scrape before anyone. What I learned a lot is that a lot of the time that I got hurt was because I was not listening to that still small voice inside of me. I wasn't listening to the good orderly direction, which really was my first G-O-D God. That I spent a lot of my life literally throwing myself in between my father and my siblings, including my older sister. I protected everybody. I never felt like I was worth being taken care of. The hardest person for me to take care of is me, still to this day, still to this day. So not having to have boundaries looks like following the directions of a higher power. That's all it looks like. Getting that channel clear is what I had to do. And that's what amends does, to get right-sized in the world. I lived in this hall of mirrors where in this one I look like Wonder Woman and that one I'm the Oompa Loompa. You know, I don't know about you, but it depended on the situation what I looked like. How do you know? Well, what do you need me to be? What do you need me to be? Right? And I'm always trying to read the situation so I know how to spin it. But amends was about, for the first time in my life, taking responsibility so that I could be right-sized. That this idea that no one's perfect. Yeah, okay, whatever. You know, there are a lot of things in AA that people say that I just hated. And I've had to do inventory on things like, God will never give you more than you can handle. Really? Really? Or how about everything happens for a reason? You know what? If that works for you, God bless you. Go in peace. You are a way bigger, a better evolved person than me. But I got to tell you, where this girl grew up, I couldn't trust that God. I couldn't trust a God that I felt was up there in the sky going, get her, get her. You know, I have two beautiful children and both of them were really sick and almost died when they were born. I don't know how to trust and rely on a God that's up there going, these little innocent souls deserve this. You know, I've just been around too much that doesn't make sense. And, you know, it says God of my understanding. And my, you know, first glib thing was, I don't get God. I'm willing to believe, but I don't get God. So I have a God of my non-understanding. And they said, honey, that's fine. You know, and you hear people say, you know, trite things like, you know, you can't have a doorknob God. Why not? Why not? Really seriously, why not? Because that's what they told me. They said, honey, if you would turn your will and your life over to the care of a doorknob, at least it'd be out of the hands of an idiot. I don't know what's best for me. That's the thing. If I can be willing to let somebody else say anything or just say it, or maybe I just shut up. Maybe I should just shut up. They told me that when I got to, I don't know, I'd be teachable. How about, I don't know. They told me that I was a great God. I don't know, it's a great God. You're open-minded. Hallelujah, let's have a party. You might make it yet, kid. I had to tell you to this day, I don't understand God. But today I know God. I know God. And what's the difference? The difference is that I don't understand why there's a pandemic. I don't know if it's understandable. But I know today that whatever doesn't speak of love doesn't speak of God, because I have seen the evidence of it. I've seen the evidence of it. And step two, all we're doing, came to believe is you're giving me evidence for why it's more logical to believe than to not believe. That's all that is. And I believe that the steps were designed to take me from belief to trust, to trust. I couldn't trust God, not on the day I walked in the doors. Then why would I trust you? The world had taught me not to trust anyone. My parents didn't take care of me. Sorry, my cat's trying to come over the top of the computer. You know, the people who were supposed to take care of me didn't. So why would I trust you or anybody else? It was logical that I trusted me first. It was, but it just wasn't working for me anymore. And they taught me also, you know, and my morality today really is this. It's not, it's good or bad. It's how's it working for you? If it's working, great, keep it. And if it's not, perhaps you want to take a look at that. I don't know. You know, maybe you want to take a look at that. That's the way I roll today. It's not good. It's not bad. It's how's it working for you? And if it's working, don't stop. You shouldn't. You know what? Let's be honest. You know, I'm a big book girl. I am. I'm a big girl. I'm a three legacies girl. I'm a traditions and concepts girl. I'm a do service kind of girl. And if I could be a just meeting maker, make it girl, I'd be it. It just doesn't work for me. I get restless, irritable, and discontented. I do. I do. I get restless, irritable, and get discontented. If I start thinking about me, I hate life. I do. I hate life. I don't know what that's about. And I either need a lot of God or a lot of booze. That's it. I don't know. Nothing else has ever done it for me. A lot of God, a lot of booze. You know, and the only way I know how to find God is through you. Through you. If you want to know God, work with others. This is a working with others program, you know? It's not about me, it's about you. It's through self-forgetting that I find. And so when I'm going, I'm making those amends. It's not about what I need to say to you, because I hear a lot of mistakes about that. What I need to tell you is, no, what do you need to hear? What can I say that would help you hear? Sometimes that's thank you. Because I am so self-centered. I will roll right over top of you and I didn't even notice. You know, one of the hardest amends I made was to one of my close friends. And we'd lost touch days before social media or cell phones. You know, when you moved away, you actually lost touch with people because we changed our phone numbers when we moved, because phone numbers were restricted to an area. Right? So unless you knew where to look them up in the phone book, you couldn't find somebody. It just didn't, you know. So I'd lost touch with her, and we were maybe, I don't know. I was probably almost 6 years sober, maybe, when I found her. And I sat there and I made amends to her. And the main thing that I told her was, I acknowledged what an incredible friend she had been to me. And I thanked her for that. And I told her that, you know, she didn't deserve how I treated her, and that I really deeply regretted how much harm I knew I had caused her. That I wanted her to know that I could see that I'd hurt her too. And what she said back to me was how much that meant to her, because she didn't think she'd mattered to me, right? And I walk away from people. I just walk away. That's what I do. One friend I made amends to, he told me, he said, we all thought you went to South America and never came home. But the truth is, I came home and I got sober. And I was like, well, I can't see anybody who drinks anymore. So that was that. And then I had to like spend years later trying to find them, because they all thought I was still in South America. I don't know. How do you help somebody who thinks like that? I don't know. I got sober when I was 21. I think a lot of it was growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, this incredible life that you guys have given me. Right? And that I've been taught to live within the context of the 12 steps. I don't just do the steps. You know, the steps are meant to be lived. They are living and breathing in my life all the time. You know, one of my things is, you know, like steps 10 and 11. I do a lot. I love steps 10 and 11. If you guys are free the last weekend in January, the Freedom Trail Conference in Boston, it's going to be a great weekend, but I'm doing the 11th step workshops, and because I love this stuff. I love this stuff. You know, this is where power comes in. You know, the way the 10th and the 11th step, like I was talking about my mind, and my mind, it just runs away with me. Like, the reason I drink so much is because I get a thought, I go and do it. I have no power over my mind, or so I think. I was so identified with this thing. I didn't understand. Like, what it says in the 11th step, it says that we can trust our mental faculties with assurance. After all, God gave us our brains to use. That think stand, it's not supposed to be upside down, guys. It was printed right side up, believe it or not. That I'm supposed to be living my life in such a way that God didn't make junk. I can trust my mental faculties with assurance, which helped me a lot, because this idea that we say so many things that are just ridiculous. Like, you know, you can't be too stupid, but you can be too smart. Come on, that's just condescending. Why do that? The truth is, all I have to be is open. I have to be open-minded, right? That it's important to me that Bill said things like, logic is good stuff. We still like it, you know? That helped me. That helped me find a seat in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, because I'm one course shy of a minor in space physics, guys. You know, like, I'm the girl who gets off on being, you know, smart, but I don't get to be smart here. It's not about how much I know with you guys. It's how much I'm willing to let go of, how much I'm willing to say I don't know. Right. And when I get to step 10, I think about it, girl from Texas. Okay. I think about it like a rodeo. You know, that old boy who's jumping up on that wild horse, right? And his job, the reason that's in the rodeo is because that was some old boy's job back in the day. If you wanted a horse, you had to go catch him, right? And they don't want to be ridden. They sure as heck don't want a saddle. So it's some old boy's job to hop up on his back and hang on for dang life, right? And he's going to get thrown off. And you know what happens to him when he gets thrown off? If he doesn't break his neck, he hops back on again. And he hangs on for trail of life until he gets thrown off again. Then he gets back up and he gets back up and gets back up until eventually one day, That horse is willing to be ridden. And all of a sudden it becomes a tool, and it'll take him where he wants to go, or it'll pull plow. That's my mind. I think, therefore I am, is not how I believe anymore. You know, I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we learn how to be open to new concepts, that we learn how to surrender, right? We learn how to trust. that I was taught that trust was earned. One penny in the piggy bank, one penny in the piggy bank, one penny in the piggy bank, one little bit at a time, right? And that eventually what happens is that I've got something of depth and weight, something of depth and weight. I am different today. I smile a lot today. I've got an incredible life today. I don't live on the sidelines of my life today. I'm not mad at everybody today. I don't think that, you know, there's a limited quantity of happiness out there today. You know, I believe in a God of abundance today because you guys taught me that. I don't believe that expectations are premeditated resentments. I don't see that in my big book. I see expect a miracle. I see that we do the impossible. That's what we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that I should have been able to trust and rely on my parents. I would rather have a broken heart than a closed one today, because broken hearts can mend. See, I came in here, I was a victim in three dimensions. I mean, literally a victim by the state of Texas. Victims never get well. They just don't. But people who are victimized can. It's what happened to me. It's not who I am today. That's what puts me back in the grace of God. See, I believe in spiritual alchemy. I actually paint with fire. That's what I do for a living. That's where I was all day, painting with fire. You know, I believe that you taught me, how do you turn a negative into a positive? That nothing is wasted in God's world. I don't know if everything happens for a reason, but I do know that nothing is wasted in God's world. I do know that I believe that no matter what happens, we do spiritual alchemy here. You know, the alchemists were trying to turn lead into gold, and here we turn crap into gold. The truth is that when the pressure gets really, really high and really, really hot, we end up with diamonds. Nothing is too big for the God that you taught me to find in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was taught to not let anybody read my big book for me. It doesn't mean that I don't do a lot of big book studies and things like that, and I do them for people and with people. But the deal is, it's got to be my experience. I have to find a relationship with the God in this big book. And the God that I found in this big book, one of the lost chapters, why don't we make everybody read them all? The family afterwards. If you haven't read it recently, please read it. It is so beautiful. We talk in the rooms all the time. Happy, joyous, and free. Happy, joyous, and free. Yeah. Like it's my right. Well, it's my birthright. That's what it is. But it says on page 132 that, you know, we're not a glum lot, right? We absolutely insist on enjoying our life. And on the top of page 133, it says, we are sure God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. That's God's ideal for me. That's the God I have to find. That's the God I have to believe in. That's the God I choose to see. See, and that's where this 10th and 11th step really comes in, right? Because when I start, if you want to know what you believe, look at your actions. How much fear have you had in the last week, right? What I choose to believe, as soon as I see that 10th step all through the day with me, watching, ask, pause, turn, cease fighting, right? As soon as I see myself in fear, in resentment, in, you know, believing in limitations and any of that, my job is to stop and realign my will to God's. No, this is the God I choose to believe in. I choose to believe in the God that wants me happy, joyous, and free. Sure, we're sure. That's the attitude. With this attitude, I cannot fail. And then, I don't know, I'll end with this because I know I'm about out of time. How many of you guys been near little kids, little toddlers, right? You ever seen any, or maybe just in the grocery store, watched a toddler have a temper tantrum? Yep. I'm the queen of the temper tantrums. Bring your worst two-year-old over. I'll take them on. I promise you, I'll take them to the mat. I will win every single time. And I'm going to invite you to have a spiritual temper tantrum with me. Don't let anybody ever decide that you have to have a bad day ever again. I'm going to have a spiritual temper tantrum. I'm going to absolutely insist on enjoying my life, no matter what happens, no matter what happens. Nothing and no one makes that decision for me, because today I choose to believe in a God that's bigger than that. And the evidence of it is all around me. It's all around me. I have this incredible life. I wouldn't trade it for anything. Honest to God, I wouldn't trade it for anything. And that's including the hardships. You know, I hate roller coasters, but what I know today is that my life has been one big roller coaster. It really has. There have been highs and there have been low, low, lows. And there are a lot of people who've never been as low as I have been. There really are. And they've had the same highs. And I thought that was unfair until I realized that the distance from the bottom to the top is the amount of joy I get to feel today. For me, being at zero is a spiritual high. Nothing, nothing and no one can keep me from insisting on enjoying my life and from practicing that gratitude today. So for that, I want to say again, David, thank you for asking me. Thank you for letting me be with you. And I hope to see you in Virginia in real life one day. God bless you.
Arisa, amazing. Thank you so much. You guys have the ability to unmute yourselves. You can.
Thank you very Arisa. Much.
Thank you. Arisa. That was awesome.
Thank you, Arisa.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Arisa.
Thank you very much.
Great
thank
talk.
You, thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're excellent, Arisa. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Good to be with you guys.
All right. I'm going to take the meeting back. We'll give Arisa a moment to breathe and we'll do a little business here. I'm going to put a link in the chat regarding the seventh tradition. And please, 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 we'll be able to ask questions when we reconvene. So please send your questions to the user questions. It's really Larry. The seventh tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. While contributions cover each rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose, to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I will take a few AA-related announcements by show of hands. All right, while you're thinking about that, Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you, do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we will be available here after we close the meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone, but you do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All right, last call for questions. Please, not last call. You can send them in as you think of them. There's not really a cutoff. I don't know why I'm being arbitrarily hard to get along with. Send in your questions. So let me pull that up and we'll pull Arisa back in. Yay, we have a few questions. That was amazing. Just delightful. Thank you so much. Our first question is, what is the last thing you had to surrender to and how does surrender happen?
Well, let's see. I don't know about you, but a lot of times we hear in the meetings things like surrender to win. I think that's stupid. It's the stupidest, one of the stupidest things I hear in AA. Surrender to win. Who does that? I mean, like Napoleon, he's going to surrender to win. Really? No. I surrender when I'm surrounded by a SWAT team. Okay. You got to pry it out of my cold, dead hands. Okay. That's the way it looks like to me. What was the last thing I surrendered to? Well, this afternoon, my 17-year-old. Okay. I mean, you know, if my arrangements would only stay put, when, you know, I surrender when I'm when I'm tired of hurting. Now, the truth is that it doesn't always have to look that way today. Thank God, right? The truth is that it's when, you know, I've learned that there are two great motivators, great love and great pain. It doesn't always have to be great pain. Great love too. I guess it would be close to 17 years ago. Hardest thing I ever did was give God my kids because they were both, like I said, they were sick. And my daughter stopped breathing twice before I got her home from the hospital. I was new to Boston and I didn't really know anybody. AA really wasn't showing up for me, you know, because I really didn't know anybody here. And here I was alone with this sick little baby. My husband was not really available at the time either. And this idea that, I mean, I couldn't keep her safe. Her intestines were swollen and bleeding. She's pooping blood. You know, I mean, it's just, it was horrifyingly hard. It really was. And yet what was different was that I didn't feel like it had happened to me. What I felt like, see that Eeyore cloud, it had gone away by this time by helping others. That's really what it was. You want to learn to surrender, help others. I felt more like God gave them the right mother. God gave them a mother who could stop the world to take care of them. God gave them, if I had had the problems my children had had, I really would have died. My kids are kids who should not have survived. And I was given the opportunity to show up for them. That's the thing. When you're living with this principle of it's not my life, it's God's. You know, when I do a third step, it's not my life. Where I work, where I live, like the only place that I ever wanted to live, the only place I never wanted to live, in case you misunderstood me, was Boston. And now I've lived here 19 years longer than I've lived anywhere else. But I've gotten to be uniquely useful here. I don't know. What I have learned is that anytime I catch myself going, not that, it's time to stop. Because I don't know what's best for me. And if I don't know what's best for me, maybe I don't know what's best for you. You know, the truth is my 17-year-old is being 17, you know? And I just wrote inventory this afternoon before coming on this meeting. Part of why I said yes to David is because I was supposed to be doing something with my 17-year-old. And that fell through and I texted him back and I said, well, my plans fell through. I'm here if you need me. And he said, yes, please. I don't get to decide anymore except to sign up for service. So that's the best I can tell you. You know, if you're not getting your way, try not having a way. That's all I can tell you. If you're looking to how to avoid your problems, you got the wrong girl on the line here. I'm the girl who, you know, add more God and it turns into a blessing. You know, it also says on that page 133, you know, but it's clear that we made our own misery. God didn't do it. Avoid then the deliberate manufacture of misery. But if troubles come, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate God, his omnipotence. And I don't know about you, but a problem plus me is misery and a problem plus God is an opportunity. This girl can turn any opportunity into misery. But it's for today. I'll go for the opportunity, hopefully. Hope that answers the question.
Awesome. Thank you. I was just kind of fantasizing about a workshop idea. We could do a workshop on stuff that they say in AA.
Oh,
it's just crazy. Okay. Sorry.
I'll sign up for that one.
That was my own personal aside. Sorry. As someone who has found themselves both servile and scraping on many occasions, what's something you've done to ensure your needs are met without causing harm to others?
10 and 11. It's about following God's direction. You know, the truth is that God didn't make junk. Like, as God's people, we walk on our feet. If you haven't finished all your amends, you know, that would be the first thing. And if you have 10, 11, and 12, you know, I'm the girl who will, you know, it was through sponsorship that I learned that I should not be doing for you anything that you can do for yourself, right? That I had to be willing to be the sponsor that I would want to have, somebody who would be willing to tell the truth, even when it was difficult, because I want you to like me. Let's be honest here. We're not people pleasers. We are not people pleasers. That's more therapy speak. We're we pleasers. I'm a me pleaser. I am totally a me pleaser. I really don't care if you like me, except that if you like me, I'm going to get what I want. That's really all it is. That's really all it is. It is me about trying to make the world more comfortable for me. See, because if you don't like me, I'm going to be uncomfortable. You know, I want to do this stuff for you. It says that we're not supposed to put our, 12-step work on a service plane. What it means by that is like, here you go. Let me hand it up to you. No, if you can do it for yourself, you need to. I need to not make it too easy for you because you're never going to get skin in the game. I don't know about this home group, but at my home group, we do not give big books away. You know why? Because at my first home group, we didn't give big books away. And you know what? In our AA literature, it tells us not to give big books away. Sponsors can buy big books for their sponsees. You can get one from a library. You can read it for free at AA.org now. But the truth is that, you know, we were taught that if it was a penny a week, you pay for it because that's how you invest. It means nothing if you paid nothing for it. Easy come, easy go. Make it a little bit harder. My sponsors set the bar high and often I tripped over it. But you know what they gave me through that? They taught me, you know what, kid, you're better than that. They didn't say it in a negative way. They said it that they believed in me and nobody had ever believed in me. They just expected me to be the difficult one. My father literally called me the bully, and I wasn't. All I was trying to do was protect everybody else. That wasn't the point of what I was trying to do. I judged me by my motives and you by your actions. How about I judge me by my actions and you by your motives? How about I put down the pen and notebook and cross the courtroom and become the lawyer for the defense for once? Servile and scraping, we're doing that to get something as a rule. You know, I feel like I'm nothing, which is why if I do this for you, I think I'll feel better about me. That's still self-pleasing. And as somebody who did a lot of that, I mean, I am the girl who literally volunteered to be punched instead of somebody else. So I hope that answers the question.
Thank you. This question was a little further down, but since it's sort of a segue to your answer to this last question, could you walk us through what practicing step 10 and 11 looks like for you on the day-to-day?
Absolutely. So I am not somebody who believes that step 10 is done at night. Okay. I believe that if you read the steps, so there are lots of different forms of inventory, one of which you can, you know, in the 12 and 12, it talks a lot about, you know, different types of inventory, and one is doing it at night. But in step 10, it talks about constantly. It says that word many, many times. I would suggest that you go through and you get a highlighter or some sort of a pen or something and circle or highlight all of the verbs. Ask, turn, watch, cease fighting. Try going, you know, you're working with just one of those words for a while. Just try watching yourself. Because how, you know, our first step is we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. You can't fix a problem if you can't properly identify it. Okay. Alcohol wasn't my problem, right? I thought it was. So I thought if I quit drinking, life gets better. But when I quit drinking, life gets worse. My problem, I have a sobriety problem. I can't stand being sober. That's my problem. That's why I keep drinking, because I can't stand being sober. So in step 10, the first thing I have to do is I have to learn to watch. I have to learn to see that there's, you know, something going on. Now, if it's hard to practice step 10 if you haven't practiced the other at least, you know, 8 steps, I would say. You know, and while you're in the amends process, you should be learning to do 10 and 11. And so I'm watching, asking, turning, pausing, cease fighting, right? Looking at how this mind is telling me garbage, you know? So, I learned that if I told you, don't think about the Mona Lisa, guess what? We're all thinking about the Mona Lisa. Okay. So one of the mistakes I made a lot was I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about that. I'm not going to think about that. And then what I'm actually doing is thinking about that, right? So step 10 is to start to notice how that hamster is getting on the wheel. It's all through the day. It's not just because I'm getting in a conflict with somebody. The whole point of step 10 is to happen before I get into conflict. Yes, once I'm there, do it as quickly and promptly as possible. But all through the day. Now, step 11 is where the nightly review is in our big book. It's a meditation, right? And the Upon Awakening, it's another meditation. Today we're very used to guided meditations. Those are written as guided meditations, right? And people talk all the time, like, my sponsor told me to read pages, 86 through, whatever. Why? What's the point in that? How about you do them, right? Read them. No, don't. The people read them and they never do them. What's it actually telling me to do, right? On awakening, let us think about the 24 hours ahead. I have my grandfather's dictionary. He died with almost 40 years of sobriety, but he died when I was in fourth grade. So, that didn't mean anything to me at the time. But he had a dictionary from 1911. And, the definition of meditation when this book was written is not what we think of today. Today, we all think we know what meditation is because it's a buzzword. There are apps for that, Meditation is closer to what we would think of today as contemplation, directed thinking. How do I choose my thoughts? My sponsor taught me that everything I do is either feeding the black dog or feeding the white dog. And I was like, but I like black dogs. I don't understand. I have two black poodles now. I don't get it, right? So, how do you help somebody like that? But what she was trying to tell me is today I talk about it more like the constant gardener. Whatever you feed will grow. If you pull the weeds when they're little, it's easy. If you wait until they're, really big, it's going to be harder. So I need to make sure that I'm planting what I want in my garden. That's the idea here, right? And so when it's talking about meditation, one of the examples in that dictionary is a general meditates his war. So think about those little tin soldiers. And if they do that, we'll go this way. But if they do this, we'll go that way. And so, when I consider my plans for the day, I start people off really simply, make a to-do list. Just make a to-do list. Those are plans, right? And then to contemplate it is, okay, here's my to-do list. God, what do you think about this list? Did I plan God in, right? Where's the thoughtfulness? Where's the kindness? Where's the love? Where's the joy? Where's the meeting? Where's the calling my sponsor? Where's the newcomer, right? So contemplate it. So here's my idea and let me ask for something bigger, right? And so when I look at these things, right? And let me go back to step 10. It says that after making our review, when we retire at night, it says after making our review, we're supposed to say this prayer, right? And it's we ask God's for forgiveness. And that really screwed me up for a while. Because again, this is this, religious training that I have, ask for God's forgiveness, and this idea that I was working with God, like, if God made me, right, then he made me human. And I read it somewhere years ago, I know exactly where, but anyway, that a spiritual person makes about 600 mistakes in a day. 600 mistakes in a day, that's like the Dalai Lama makes 600 mistakes in a day. And I'm not willing to find two. I'm the girl who needs to be perfect, right? As if that's possible. It's not possible if you're human to be perfect, except perfectly human. So shoot for 600 mistakes in a day. Instead of did I make any mistakes today? How about where's Waldo? Where are the mistakes? See if you can find them, make a game out of it. I mean, that's more the way I try to think about it. I know, so that's why the first question is like, this afternoon, that was, I'm not perfect, but I am willing to be imperfect today. I'm willing to be imperfect today. AA is not a hotbed of mental health, honey. It just isn't. We got to be who we are, because if we aren't willing to be where we are and who we are, we can't go past that. Now, just in case, for those big book lawyers out there, just in case you think I'm full of crap, on page 87, it says, we usually conclude the period of meditation with a prayer, right? So if you go back to those pages and instead of reading them, ask yourself, like really, really try to experience them and do them. If you want to join me on Wednesday mornings at 7 a.m., a spiritual exercises meeting that we do, we break steps 10 and 11 into the five main aspects and we go into them in depth. And it's one of my favorite meetings. And that's also what we'll be doing on that other weekend. But what I found is that I have to build spiritual muscles. These are spiritual exercises, just like going to the gym. When I first went to the gym, I couldn't lift any weight at all. But every day that as I realign my will, now here I'll say something else controversial, okay? I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is about building more self-will. How about that? I know everybody's telling you, you got to get rid of self-will. But what it says in steps 10 and 11 is that, you know, I'm actually supposed to be learning to align my will to God's, right? And earlier, like, this is the proper use of the will, right? The more I align it to God's, the stronger I get. That's in step 10, you know, like, so this is what I choose to believe. This is what I choose to believe. This is, see, because in step 3, it's a decision. It's a decision. This is the decision that I'm making. Now, what is the action that's going to follow up with it? Those are the pennies in the piggy bank. This is what I choose to believe. But I'm thinking about this judgmental God, but this is what I'm going to put. You can only have what you aim for. So make sure you're clear about that. Choose. We do have power, choice, and control at a certain point in our life, never over alcohol. That's been taken off the table. A good parent doesn't let their children choose whether or not they're going to play with knives. They keep them in a locked drawer. God doesn't put alcohol on the table for me. That's gone. But I do get to choose whether or not I'm going to continue on this path and continue to improving my relationship with that higher power. That's what I get to do today. And that's a really tight synopsis. Sorry, but we could go for days.
Wonderful. Thank you. Would you be willing to describe your current relationship with your parents?
Absolutely. My mother died a little over a year ago. I spent the last 25 years of her life with her quite a lot. And she was actually the one that I had the biggest resentment against because she didn't save me from my dad. My mother and I are very, very different people. She's a very cold, calculating, you know, kind of person. And she was harsh and she really literally didn't save me. And she did a lot of things like my inventory on my mom was long and hard and difficult. And suiting up and showing up as a daughter, the daughter that I wanted to be, the daughter that I wanted to be. That's what I was taught to do, to be the daughter that I hope to have, right? To start thinking about it that way, not whether or not my mother deserved to have that daughter, but the daughter that I would want to be. And, you know, back in the day, it was writing letters to her. And I took myself and then my family down for at least 2 weeks every year for the last 25 years to spend time with her so that my kids got to grow up with her, right? So that they got to see the best of her. I didn't have anything in common with my mother, nothing really. And so I would call her up and I'd say, how do you roast a turkey? Because she's a pretty good cook, right? Or I'd ask her questions about things she's good at because I never let anybody parent me. Never let anybody parent me. You know, with that first time that I remember asking for help and she said no, I never went back. I found out about, I don't want to say 8-10 years ago, I guess it's longer than that now. Anyway, I came across my older sister's report card. My older sister's report card when we were, you know, in elementary school. And she had all these C's on it. And I thought she was the perfect. And I could never live up to her. And by the way, I was making straight A pluses. And I was always the stupid one in the family. And I had no idea. And I'd come home with a perfect report card. And she'd say, well, that's nice. But, you know, if you had C's on it too, we'd as long as that's your best effort. And so nothing was ever good enough to get my mom to say, good job. You know, nothing ever was. And she just didn't understand me. She really didn't. I'm a girl who paints with fire. I mean, what are you going to do? Who understands that anyway, right? I don't know. But we came together on a whole different way. She got a daughter that I don't think she was expecting either. And the truth is that she got cancer and it was ugly and she didn't have any treatment whatsoever. She had some nodules removed and then she didn't have another scan done. And I was the one that put her into hospice the last year of her life. I think I was down there 5-6 times. I was there for Mother's Day. I was there for Easter. And I was the only one there. And like I said, I put her into hospice. She had a list of things she wanted done around the house, and I did them. And then all of a sudden, things got weird, really weird. And she became the mother that I grew up with. And she was really mean, really, really mean and cold again. And to the extent where she called, I got a notice that I was to show up at her house where she's moved all of a sudden to next door to my sister. And I was to show up to her house and get the things that she had bequeathed to me on Thursday. I could be there from Thursday afternoon to Friday afternoon. By the way, getting to her house takes about 10 hours from where I live if I can get a flight. I could not on that. This is Monday afternoon when I get this summons. Couldn't get a moving company. I've had two back surgeries, and I asked if I could have a little extra time. And she said, you know, I know you've got problems, but I'm more important. And then I show up there and she called the police on me. And I didn't know what was going on. She was, you know, it was ugly. And when she was really close to the end, I couldn't go because I was with my husband and his father who was dying. And, you know, I was with them. So here, and my mother died, and my sister scheduled the funeral for before my father-in-law had died. And I said, I don't know if I can come. And they said, well, hopefully you can. And that was that. And he died. And the day after, I flew to West Virginia for my mother's funeral. And there I found out that they had texted me that she had died the day before. You know, they threatened to disinherit me and all kinds of crazy stuff. And here's the difference. I never once made a jerk out of myself. Not once. Nobody can make me be anything but a woman of grace and dignity today. You know, and about, I don't know, 2 months later, I realized, you know, I bet the cancer got in her brain. I bet it was in her prefrontal cortex, you know, you know, and I didn't have to create more crap for everybody. I could have said how wrong they are, could have done that. And I've been justified. What about justifiable anger? It hurts me. It still hurts me. And then my dad, I have a great relationship with my dad, shockingly, because he was the one I never, ever wanted to get anywhere close to. The truth is, he's the one that always told me I could do anything I wanted to. He's the one that when I said I wanted to be an artist, he said, cool. You know, he's the one that taught me to draw. He's the one that, you know, years ago, a couple years sober, and he was coming at me, and I knew he was about to hit me. And I put my hand on a crystal ball and I looked at him and I said, if you touch me, I will call the police and I will press charges. And ever since then, we've had a great relationship, you know, that's it. And, you know, the main thing I learned was how to set him up to succeed, to put him in situations where he's comfortable to, you know, I've never left him alone with my kids. I'm not stupid. But he's actually the only grandparent they ever had who would actually play with them, you know? And he's the only one still alive. And he's still trying to be a part of their life. And he tells them how great they are, you know? And I don't know, I mean, there were a lot of crazy things going on when I was a kid, but you know, they would have missed that if I just cut them out of my life. They would have missed that. And so I think that my relationships with them were healed, and because nobody can steal those 25 years back, you know, from me because of the last 3 months of my mother's life. I know how much I meant to her. I know what kind of a relationship we built. And that was a relationship that I didn't deserve to have. I got it because of grace. You have to put yourself in the path of grace, though.
Thank you so much, Arisa. Just beautiful. I don't know about you, but this has been a rapid hour and a half.
I'm always goes quicker when I'm speaking.
So thank you so much. We are out of time. Everyone will have the opportunity once again after the Lord's Prayer to unmute and thank our dear Arisa one more time. And in the meantime, could I get a kind volunteer to read the last three paragraphs on page 164. Maybe one of the home group members who's a co-host. I swear I'm going to do it right about
hey
now.
David, right about I'm Leanne. I'm an alcoholic.
Thanks, Leanne.
A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you all for an amazing meeting. Thank you, Larry, for wrangling the questions, everyone for participating. If we could, let's virtually circle up and hold hands and actually say the Lord's Prayer. Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory forever and ever. Amen.